Bad luck isn't brought by broken mirrors, but by broken minds. Suspiria, 1977 version. In 1977, we are introduced to a horror movie with a very unusual name, Suspiria. I so casually say we for literary effect, but let's be honest, I was 5 at the time. I met Suspiria later in a mom and pop video store on VHS. But mom and pop video stores are another story for another episode. It's Italian giallo, the murder mystery horror movies that were the predecessors to the American slasher movie. Directed by Dario Argento, who often cast his own wife and daughter in the roles of murder victims. We know this is going to be a strange ride, but we have no idea. Hi, this is Carla, and welcome to There Might Be Cupcakes, episode 51, Elegant Nastiness. Watching the movie, we open upon a rainstorm with oversaturated colors. The blues and the reds and the purples are aggressive, and so are the shadows. A fragile-looking pale girl rides in the back of a taxi, and the rain is pounding on the windows, as if it's trying to get into the taxi cab at her, as if this storm is personal. The movie soundtrack sounds as if it's trying to get at this poor girl as well. It starts with gentle bells. Bells that remind the frequent horror viewer of The Exorcist. So we horror fans recognize this sound and we think we know what we're in for several seconds. Then the soundtrack literally flips the script and adds the most discordant electronic string sounds over the bells and this deep whoomp, whoomp, whoomp sound. Sit up in your chair, these sounds demand. Get nervous. This is not the scare you anticipate. This is not the horror landscape you know. And the frail girl trapped in the back seat continues to squirm and try to peer out the oppressive rain. And we squirm. She arrives at her destination, a foreboding and looming building that appears deserted, until another girl throws herself out its front door. This girl's shouting something back through into the door, but we and our frail girl in the car can't quite hear her shouts over the driving rain and over the soundtrack, which has an added element now, over the discordant electronica and instruments and the bells. A hostile voice is repeatedly hissing the word, "Witch! Witch! Witch!" Welcome to the Tanz School of Dance in Freiburg, Germany. Susie Banyan has arrived to study ballet, and we have arrived in the askew, oversaturated, dreamlike fairy tale world of Suspiria. Authority figures may not be what they seem. Architecture and dance are both spell work, and booby traps lie behind doors for sneaky, snooping girls. To quote the horror movie expert, and for the sake of transparency, my very nice Facebook friend, Kim Newman, Dario Argento's innocence adrift in a nightmare world where any object, from a simple window to a work of art, can be transformed into an instrument of death. And it is true. Metal where you do not belong, and the building itself attacks. For architecture truly is spellwork for these witches in the Three Mothers series, as I will explain. But it's more than that. Suspiria has the quality of a dream, in which you go through a door that you know leads to the dance studio, but instead inexplicably leads to a pit of barbed wire, which is never to be found again by anyone else. The rest of the movie is a fever dream of a fairy tale. Secret passageways, disappearances, nightmares, witches, secret doors, overwrought fear, and always overwrought colors, oversaturated blues and reds assaulting your vision and keeping you on edge as fragile Susie Banyan grows tougher and realizes that her dance school is a facade for something evil. This movie's narrative is not tied up in a nice bow at the end. This movie is a feeling, not a story. Again, to quote Kim Newman, Argento's Three Mothers films make no narrative sense, and indeed make a point of it, but deliver an overwhelming effect through imagery, music, editing, high style, beautiful people, surreal lighting, monumental architecture, and elegant nastiness. This is more so true for the sequel, Inferno. While Suspiria is about Mater Suspiriorum, the mother of sighs, Inferno is about Mater Tenebriarum, the mother of pain. Confusingly enough, Argento also made a horror movie called Tenebrae, which one would think would be the logical name for the Mater Tenebrarum movie, but Tenebrae is a murder mystery horror movie. Inferno goes into the details of the three mothers, but other than that, is a glorious narrative mess. An antique dealer neighbor glowers. An invalid in the building in question inserts herself into the oddness in hand. Meanwhile, the mother figures in the movie, the caretakers or landlords of the apartment building, it's never quite clear their role. The spooky architecture of this movie for this series revolves around three buildings, about which I'll explain in a moment. Loom, leer, and intrude. People again die in bizarre fashion. With Argento, it's debatable how much story he actually needs as connecting tissue between his scenes of exquisite mayhem. Kim Newman and James Herriot, horror, 333 films to scare you to death. And when we're talking about exquisite mayhem in Inferno, we mean cats. Lots of cats. Enchanted cats. Enchanted attack cats. Let me read from my longtime friend Brian's Letterboxd review. Ryan, who's a friend way back from Usenet's alt.horror days, is known then and now in the online horror community as Tyrannorabbit. And Tyrannorabbit's takes on horror movies are often better than the actual movies. I will link to his Letterboxd review feed in the show notes if you are so inclined. But for now, Tyrannorabbit explains Inferno and Inferno's cats. Quote, "This might not be the best Argento, but it does seem to be the most Argento. Big panels of lurid primary colors, a dipshitty male protagonist I'm guessing even fans don't like, and an anti-plot that repeatedly follows one pretty girl through a harrowing ordeal and a horrible death, and then replaces her with another. It's got beautiful shots and sequences all over the place, but I wasn't expecting this one to be quite so funny. Maybe not intentionally, but you try not laughing when the cats are brought in. The sight of all these cats being thrown at a cast member from off screen, well, those cats cannot hide their body language, and they're all saying, 'What the fuck, man? Stop throwing me!' Those cats are dealt with by the textbook, old school, and cruel solution to what to do with a bunch of unwanted cats, made hilarious, possibly more intentionally, by the process being dragged out by some mobility issues. And there's this goddamn song, which is like a prog rock version of Avi Santani, Big as Life and Twice as Bouncy, inexplicably used during a scene of quiet, potentially spooky exploration. I don't know if I can ever get entirely on their Argento wavelength, but it worked here often enough for me to ensure I had a good time, and it doesn't ever stay." Unquote. To show you how very disjointed Inferno is, here's my short and sweet Letterboxd review. My Letterboxd link is in the show notes and on the website. Quote, "Great soundscape, but awful soundtrack. Not Goblin. Except for the classical music. Same color scheme as Suspiria, which was enjoyable. Bizarre and abrupt ending. Were those two ladies that lived at the building witches? And where did they go? Why did the mater who lived there seem to want to burn it down? So many questions unanswered." Unquote. And thus we return to the music of Suspiria, ringing the ambiance of the exorcist's tubular bells but hissing "witch" at us over unsettling discord. The original Suspiria is as known for its soundtrack, written and performed by the band Goblin, as it is for its oversaturation of color and murderous insanity. The incredible album was released on June 15, 1977, and it is considered art rock or progressive rock or prog rock, in the same genre as Pink Floyd, King Crimson, Jethro Tull, and yes, Mike Oldfield, the composer and artist of the Exorcist Tubular Bells theme. Part of the theme song was used in the trailer, oddly enough, for the 2011 version of Jane Eyre, starring Mia Wasikowska and Michael Fassbender, and I have no explanation for that. In 2018, Claudio Simonetti, which is one of my very favorite Italian names, Claudio Simonetti, an original member of Goblin and Goblin's current lineup, went on a Suspiria tour to celebrate the film's remake. They played the full soundtrack alongside a screening of the 1977 version. Simonetti said in a recent interview that the soundtrack album was the band's best work. I will link to this article in the show notes and in this episode's website entry. The soundtrack song titles read like a fairy tale book's chapters and are intriguing in themselves. There are 20th, 30th, and 40th anniversary track editions, some of which are interviews and alternate takes songs, but the original lineup is Suspiria, Witch, Opening to the Sighs, Marcos, Black Forest, Blind Concert, and Death Valser. As I said in my review of Inferno, boy, howdy, the soundtrack to Inferno was not performed by Goblin. It was composed and performed by another prog rock performer, and I didn't see this coming, Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake and Palmer. I don't believe Emerson had any experience nor interest in the horror genre at all. The soundtrack feels divorced from the movie, like you're listening to some random prog rock album while watching it. While Suspiria's soundtrack feels like a character in the movie, and an oppressive, dangerous character at that. Mother of Tears, the third in the trilogy, returns to its musical roots. The score is by Claudio Simonetti of Goblin, and it feels more organic to the story. It's not as part of the story as Suspiria's, but it's a massive improvement from Inferno's. It feels congruent and as if it's continuing the eerie story. Before I talk about Mother of Tears, let me explain the series as a whole. These movies are about three very powerful witches and one architect who dabbled in alchemy. That's it, really? Well, I'm being flippant, but that's what it boils down to. Three ancient witches find an alchemic architect to build homes for them, homes that would also be their sources of power. The source of this mythology is Thomas de Quincey, who is best known for his memoir, Confessions of an Opium Eater. In his 19th century work, Suspiria de Profundis, which in Latin means sighs from the depths, he wrote an essay titled Lavanna and Her Ladies, which inspired this universe and these witches. I will discuss De Quincey's work more in the second episode about Three Mothers films and mythology. So here's the story and backstory. In the 11th century, these three women actually invented witchcraft on the shores of the Black Sea. They learned the secret to immortality in doing so, and then wandered the world, gathering wealth and power, and leaving death and chaos in their wake. There are hints that these witches are death itself, death personified. And everything hinted at in the series is more fully explored in the 2018 remake of Suspiria. In the 19th century, these witches commissioned, from an architect named Varelli, three immense homes from which each would live, hide, and draw their power. Because when you're immortal, you do need a place to hide, because people eventually notice that you don't change. Alchemy and symbolism are used in their homes' geographical placement, design, and construction. Varelli writes in a memoir titled The Three Mothers, a confession of sorts, sharing the blueprints and design of each home, and stating that he learned too late of how evil these women were. These buildings are evil in their construction and in their own right, and are slowly but surely infecting the land around them as well. One of these homes is the Tanz Dance Academy in Freiburg, Germany, which is run by a coven of witches, who protect the ancient Mater Suspiriorum, the Mother of Sighs, and do her bidding. A dance academy is the perfect use for the building because it attracts beautiful young women, who can either be brought into the coven as new life blood or used for their life energy and beauty. The Mother of Sighs is the oldest and wisest of the mothers. Mater Tenebriarum, the Mother of Darkness, is the youngest and cruelest of the three. She resides in New York City. She masquerades as a nurse working for an invalid living in her apartment building, using a spell known as the glamour to disguise her appearance to others. We learn along with the protagonist that this professor that she's protecting is the architect Varelli, trapped as Tenebriarum's slave. When the titular inferno occurs, several copies of Varelli's memoir of the Three Mothers burn with it. Mother Lacrimarum, the Mother of Tears, lives, of course, in Rome, which is where the final showdown takes place. The main character in Mother of Tears, Sarah, was a brief character in Inferno. We learn that her parents fought the Mother of Sighs before the actions of Suspiria took place, greatly weakening her and therefore making it possible for Susie Banyan to defeat her in Suspiria. Sarah defeats the Mother of Tears in the catacombs of Rome. It's presumably, according to the movie, undiscovered catacombs under the mother's house. while the other mother's homes serve purposes to lure in people, apartment building, a dance academy. The Mother of Tears home is simply a huge, now crumbling mansion. They don't talk about what it used to be, whose home it used to be. Now, here's my Mothers of Tears review from Letterboxd. Quote, better than I expected it to be. Much better. Stars removed for the ending. No one is that agile with a huge spear-induced chest wound like that. And what was so goddamn funny? How weird. What a shot to end on. And for the kids' TV grab-ass ghost imagery. That ghost. I can't with that ghost. The scenery is lovely. The tie-in with Suspiria is fun. The horror imagery is through the roof, and the gore pulls no punches. Read. Two babies and one young child are murdered graphically and on screen, and the camera does not look away in the R-rated version. I cannot fathom the unrated version. Also, a nice touch I noticed as a history buff, all of the murder implements were medieval torture devices. But I can't with that ghost and that last shot. I just can't. Unquote. Yes, those murder implements. They were all medieval torture devices. Thank you for my wonderful AP European history teacher, Mr. Curtis. Hi, Mr. Curtis. Which does make me wonder about the Mother of Tears' background role in inciting the Inquisition. That's an interesting creative thought. And there is no escape from these witches in this universe. They have inserted themselves into your vocation, your avocation, and your entertainment, Suspiria, your home, neighborhood, and way of life, Inferno, and your religion and religious life, Mother of Tears. Their tendrils reach far and deep, and appearances are deceiving. No one can be trusted. As I said, a nurse entrusted to heal may be evil incarnate. Your kindly landlord may be a witch in her service. Your ballet teacher, in whom you entrust the well-being of your very body, may be a witch out of the very worst uncensored fairy tale. Think about how intimate dance practice is. Your priest confessor might be enchanted by death herself, in too deep to save himself. And as in Mother of Tears, when chaos is unleashed, the very streets you walk every day are unsafe. In this universe, magic is mostly used for personal gain and power, and to rid oneself of any adversary. Blood will flow if you cross a witch. It is only in Mother of Tears that a witch with benevolent powers is shown. Witchcraft means locked doors will not protect you, and you do not know who to trust. Love and manipulation, they share houses very often. They are frequent bedfellows. Suspiria, 2018 version. Now, how does the 2018 remake fit into this universe? Well, and it actually fills out some of the above details and answers some questions that Argento's 1977 movie only hints at. It's different. It starts with Susie Banyan attending the same Tanz ballet school, but it tells the similar story by way of a different plot. The angry political and racial theater of 1977 Germany is a character in the Suspiria, for yes, it's set in the year that the original was made, which is a really cool touch. It also begins not with Susie assaulted by a portentous rainstorm, but by a pounding knock on a psychiatrist's door. A crazed girl comes to her psychiatrist raving about witches, waving her journal about. She's distraught and is either having a psychotic episode or is complete terror. She's showing pages in her journal, sketches she's made, how she's drawn together this person to that person. And when she feels she isn't believed, she runs out into the night, forgetting her journal. Then we return to the familiar scene of Susie coming to dance school. Susie in this version is more vocal, stronger. She speaks up and back to her dance teachers. Susie in the original was quiet in response to the sass of her fellow students and the strange outbursts of her teachers. This Susie wants to be taught, but she has plenty to say as well. There's a notoriously difficult dance piece that the teachers want to discuss, and Susie surprises them by telling them that by studying the documentary made about it and its choreographer, she knows it and can perform its difficult contortions. And she does so, unknowingly being used to perform a grisly spell with her body to hurt another student in one of the most shocking murders of the movie. The side-by-side modern dance and death in another dance studio honestly took my breath away. Movement is never mute, It is a language. It's a series of energetic shapes written in the air like words forming sentences, like poems, like prayers, like spells. Suspiria, 2018 version. I loved that the remake was a deeper retelling rather than a remake per se. It stayed true to the rules of the universe while not being a mimic of Argento's distinctive style, which is a surrounding and sometimes assaultive soundscape and soundtrack, which are two different things. Overly saturated blues, reds, and purples, and a distinctive Italianness that comes through even when the actors are American. Two interesting aspects of these movies, besides witches, that show up repeatedly in fairy tales and folklore, are the student surpassing the master and an underling eavesdropping. The former is most prevalent in the remake of Suspiria in the role of Susie, and in The Mother of Tears, as Sarah fights Mater Lacrimarum, encouraged by the spirit of her mother and by her mother's friend, a medium who can see spirits. The latter, eavesdropping, plays a role in all four films. In Inferno, the ability to eavesdrop is actually a peculiarity of the architecture itself. Elise, a tenant of the apartment building, explains that she and the missing Rose Elliott learned that if you stand in certain positions in the hallway and whisper, your voice will be projected all over the apartment in front of you, as if you were throwing your voice, allowing the tenant to listen in and to secret messages while still being hidden inside their apartment. So, fairy tales. This is no accident. To quote Dario Argento, "We were trying to reproduce the colors of Walt Disney's Snow White. It has been said from the beginning that Technicolor lacked subdued shades and was without nuances, like cut-out cartoons. So the set pieces, the color, and the anamorphic lenses were all inspired by 1937 Snow White. And so was the leading lady. The 1977 Susie Banyan, Jessica Harper, is slight and fragile-looking, pale with dark eyes and dark hair and large dark eyes. And Argento has confirmed she was cast due to her resemblance to Disney's Snow White and to the Snow White of Grimm's Fairy Tales." So I'm going to end this episode, part one of the Three Mothers universe, by reading the original Snow White to you. Before I read the fairy tale, I'll share with you what I will address in the upcoming episode about this universe and these movies. I'll be discussing De Quincey's source, Suspiria de Profundis and Levana and Our Ladies in detail. It's a really interesting work. I'll also be talking about the role of the triad in these movies. It goes way deeper than you think. Plus, I'll be talking more about geography and architecture as symbolism and spell work, such as ley lines and, yes, cathedrals. I also want to delve further into how both witchcraft and motherhood are depicted differently in each movie. And I have some fascinating trivia to round out this heavy deep dive into the womb. Before I begin reading to you, which I so love to do, I want to tell you how much I've missed this. Thanks to my wonderful oral maxillofacial surgeon, my jaw is fine again, and I'm back in black and 5x5, telling stories with abandon. And I am also determined to podcast now through the pain, devoting my only spoons to it. So there's going to be more episodes more often. It's too important to me to allow my health to take it from me. For those that don't know, please let me explain my long absence since episode 50. I had a rather spooky and painful cyst, for lack of a better term, on my lower right jawbone. I didn't know if it was a tumor. I didn't know what was going on. It was really scary. And not only was it adding to my overall general daily pain, it was impeding my speech. I tried and recorded a sample, and you could really hear the difference. It caused a mumble and a slur, neither which is desirable to listen to. I already have a distinctive voice. You either love it or you don't. No one wants to listen to me slur and mumble on top of my southern accent, and my occasional dysphagia, which causes me to stumble over words. So, I waited for my general practitioner's verdict. He sent me to my EDS doctor. I waited for that appointment. He sent me to an ear, nose, and throat doctor. I waited. She sent me to both physical therapy and oral maxillofacial surgeon, and bingo! It was a massive infection trapped down by my jawbone, most likely allowed in by a combination of EDS's effect on my teeth and EDS's effect on my loose jaw joint, letting the infection in. I'll spare you the details. I'm healed up now, and I'm doing physical therapy on every muscle from my shoulders up, to keep all of these joints in place. No more spooky tumor-like things, no more mumbling and slurring. And barring grueling pain and fatigue, no more long absences. I miss you guys, and I miss this too much when I don't do it. I'm a storyteller. I'm a writer. So, where was I? A pretty, pale girl with dark eyes and dark hair arrives to the enclave, the castle, if you will, of a strange woman who is to be her surrogate mother, her stepmother. It is a dark and stormy night, once upon a time. Little Snow White by Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm. It was in the middle of winter, when the broad flakes of snow were falling around, that a certain sweet queen sat working at her window, the frame of which was made of fine black ebony, and as she was looking out on the snow, she pricked her finger, and three drops of blood fell upon it. Then she gazed thoughtfully down on the red drops which sprinkled the white snow and said, "Oh, would that my little daughter be as white as that snow, as red as that blood, and as black as the ebony window frame." And so her little girl grew up. Her skin was as white as snow, her cheeks as rosy as blood, and her hair as black as ebony. And she was called Snow White. But this queen died, and the king soon married another wife, who was very beautiful, but so proud that she could not bear to think that anyone could surpass her. She had a magical looking glass, to which she used to go and gaze upon herself in it and say, "Tell me, glass, tell me true, of all the ladies in the land, who is fairest, tell me who." And the glass answered, "Thou, queen, art fairest in the land." But Snow White grew more and more beautiful, and when she was 7 years old, she was as bright as the day and fairer than the queen herself. Then the glass one day answered queen when she went to consult it as usual, "Thou, queen, mayest fairest and beauteous be, but Snow White is lovelier far than thee." When the queen heard this, she turned pale with rage and envy, and calling to one of her servants said, "Take Snow White away into the wide wood, that I may never see her more." Then the servant led the little girl away, but his heart melted when she begged him to spare her life, and he said, I will not hurt thee, thou pretty child." So he left her there alone, and though he thought it most likely that the wild beasts would tear her to pieces, he felt as if a great weight were taken off his heart when he had made up his mind not to kill her, but leave her to her fate. Then poor Snow White wandered along through the wood in great fear, and the wild beasts roared around, but none did her any harm. In the evening she came to a little cottage, and went in there to rest, for her weary feet would carry her no further. Everything was spruce and neat in the cottage, and the table was spread a white cloth, and there were 7 little plates with 7 little loaves, and 7 little glasses with wine in them, and knives and forks laid in order, and by the wall stood 7 little beds. Then, as she was exceedingly hungry, she picked a little piece off each loaf, and drank a very little wine out of each glass. And after that she thought she would lie down and rest. So she tried all the little beds, and one was too long, and another was too short, until the last, the 7th, suited her, and there she laid herself down and went to sleep. Presently in came the masters of the cottage, who were 7 little dwarfs, who lived among the mountains, and dug and searched about for gold. They lighted up their 7 lamps, and saw directly that all was not right. The first said, "Who has been sitting on my stool?" The second, "Who has been eating off my plate?" The third, "Who has been picking at my bread?" The fourth, "Who has been meddling with my spoon?" The fifth, "Who has been handling my fork?" The sixth, "Who has been cutting with my knife?" The seventh, "Who's been drinking my wine?" Then the first looked around and said, "Who's been lying in my bed?" And the rest came running to him, and everyone cried out that somebody had been upon his bed. But the 7th saw Snow White and called upon his brethren to come and look at her. And they cried out with wonder and astonishment, and they brought their lamps and gazed upon her. They said, Good heavens, what a lovely child she is. And they were delighted to see her, and they took care not to waken her. And the seventh dwarf slept an hour with each of the other dwarfs in turn, till the night was gone. In the morning, Snow White told them all her story, and they pitied her, and said if she would keep all things in order, and cook, and wash, and knit, and spin for them, she might stay where she was, and they would take good care of her. Then they went out all day long to their work, seeking for gold and silver in the mountains. And Snow White remained at home, and they warned her, saying, "The queen will soon find out where you are, so take care and let no one in." But the queen, now that she thought Snow White was dead, believed that she was certainly the handsomest lady in the land, so she went to her glass and said, "Tell me, glass, tell me true. Of all the ladies in the land, who is fairest? Tell me who." And the glass answered, "Thou queen, thou art fairest in all this land, but over the hills and the greenwood shade, where the seven dwarfs their dwelling have made, there Snow White is hiding, and she is lovelier farther, O queen, than thee." Then the queen was very much alarmed, before she knew that the glass always spoke the truth, and she was sure that her servant had betrayed her. And as she could not bear to think that anyone lived who was more beautiful than she was, she disguised herself as an old peddler woman and went her way over the hills to the place where the dwarfs dwelt. Then she knocked at the door and cried, "Fine wares to sell." Snow White looked out of the window and said, "Good day, good woman, what have you to sell?" "Good wares, fine wares," replied she, "laces and bobbins of all colors." "I'll let the old lady in. She seems to be a very good sort of body," thought Snow White. So she ran down and unbolted the door. "Bless me," said the woman, "how badly your stays are laced. Let me lace them up with one of my nice new laces." Snow White did not dream of any mischief, so she stood up before the old woman, who set to work so nimbly and pulled the lace so tightly that Snow White lost her breath and fell down as if she were dead. "There's the end of all thy beauty," said the spiteful queen, and went away home. In the evening the seven dwarfs returned, and I need not say how grieved they were to see their faithful Snow White stretched upon the ground motionless, as if she were quite dead. However, they lifted her up, and when they found what was the matter, they cut the lace, and in a little time she began to breathe, and soon came to herself again. Then they said the old woman was the queen. "Take care another time, and let no one in while we were away." When the queen got home, she went to her glass and spoke to it. But to her surprise, it replied in the same words as before. Then the blood ran cold in her heart with spite and malice to hear that Snow White still lived, and she dressed herself up again in a disguise, but very different from the one she wore before, and took with her a poisoned comb. When she reached the dwarf's cottage, she knocked at the door and cried, "Fine wares to sell." But Snow White said, "I dare not let anyone in." And the queen said, "Only look at my beautiful combs," and gave her the poisoned one. And it looked so pretty that the little girl took it up and put it in her hair to try it. But the moment it touched her head, the poison was so powerful that she fell down senseless. "There you may lie," the queen said, and went her way. But by good luck, the dwarfs returned very early that evening, and when they saw Snow White lying on the ground, they thought what had happened, and soon found the poisoned comb. And when they took it away, she recovered, and told them all that had passed, and they warned her once more not to open the door to anyone. Meantime, the queen went home to her glass, and trembled with rage when she received exactly the same answer as before. And she said, "Snow White shall die if it costs me my own life." So she went secretly into a chamber and prepared a poisoned apple. The outside looked very rosy and tempting, but whosoever tasted it was sure to die. Then she dressed herself up as a peasant's wife and traveled over the hills to the dwarf's cottage and knocked at the door. But Snow White put her head out of the window and said, "I dare not let anyone in, for the dwarfs have told me not to." "Do as you please," said the old woman, "but at any rate, take this pretty apple. I'll make you a present of it." No, said Snow White. I dare not take it. You silly girl, answered the other. What are you afraid of? Do you think it's poisoned? Come, do you eat one part, and I will eat the other. Now the apple was so prepared that one side was good, that the other side was poisoned. But Snow White was very much tempted to taste, for the apple looked exceedingly nice. And when she saw the old woman eat, she could refrain no longer. But she had scarcely put the piece in her mouth when she fell down dead upon the ground. This time nothing will save thee, said the queen. And she went home to her glass. And at last it said, Thou, queen, art the fairest of all the fair. And then her envious heart was glad and as happy as such a heart could be. When evening came and the dwarfs returned home, they found Snow White lying on the ground. No breath passed her lips, and they were afraid that she was quite dead. They lifted her up and combed her hair and washed her face with wine and water, but all was in vain. So they laid her down upon a bier, and all seven watched and bewailed her 3 whole days. And then they proposed to bury her, but her cheeks were still rosy, and her face looked just as it did when she was alive. So they said, We will never bury her in the cold ground. And they made a coffin of glass so that they still might look at her, and wrote her name upon it in golden letters, and that she was a king's daughter. The coffin was placed upon the hill, and one of the dwarfs always sat by it and watched. And the birds of the air came too and bemoaned Snow White. First of all came an owl, and then a raven, but last of all came a dove. And thus Snow White lay there for a long, long time, and still only looked as though she was asleep. For she was even now as white as snow, and as red as blood, and as black as ebony. At last a prince came and called at the dwarf's house, and he saw Snow White and read what was written in golden letters. Then he offered the dwarfs money, and earnestly prayed them to let him take her away. But they said, We will not part with her for all the gold in the world. At last, however, they had pity on him and gave him the coffin. But the moment he lifted it up to carry it home with him, the piece of apple fell from between her lips. And Snow White awoke and exclaimed, Where am I? And the prince answered, Thou art safe with me. Then he told her all that had happened and said, I love you better than all the world. Come with me to my father's palace, and you shall be my wife. Snow White consented and went home with the prince, and everything was prepared with great pomp and splendor for their wedding. To the feast was invited, among the rest, Snow White's old enemy, the queen, and as she was dressing herself in fine rich clothes, she looked in the glass and said, Tell me, glass, tell me true, of all the ladies in the land, who is fairest, tell me who? And the glass answered, Thou, lady, art the loveliest here, I ween. But lovelier far is the new-made queen. When she heard this, the queen started with rage. But her envy and curiosity were so great that she could not help setting out to see the bride. And when she arrived and saw that it was no other than Snow White, whom she thought had been dead a long while, she choked with passion and fell ill and died. But Snow White and the prince lived and reigned happily over that land many, many years.